I call this meeting of House Military Veterans Affairs to order. It is 1:02 p.m. Tuesday the 16th. We're in the Gruenberg Room at the State Capitol in Juneau. With me, I have Representative Gray, Representative Groh, Representative Rouser. We do have a quorum to conduct business. First off, I'd like to thank Ms. Talia Ames with the Juneau LIO for moderating today's meeting. Thank you, Ms. Talia Ames. Also, Mr. Kevin Allen, thank you. He's with House Records. Thank you for documenting today's meeting. We have two items on the agenda today. First is SB 154, Military Contract Preference, from Senator Wilkowski. This is our first hearing on this piece of legislation. With us today to present SB 154 is Senator Wilkowski and his staff, Mr. Caleb Callahan. Senator Wilkowski and Mr. Callahan, please come forth and put yourself on the record. Let the record reflect, Representative Sadler has joined us. Let the record reflect, Representative Ben Carpenter has joined us.
Thank you, representatives of the Military and Veterans Affairs Committee. My name is Caleb Callahan. I am an intern for Senator Wilkowski. Thank you for hearing our bill today.
Thank you. Let the record reflect that Representative Shaw has joined us. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this bill looks to strengthen the transition of military service members into the civilian workforce. So it encourages businesses to partner with programs like DoD SkillBridge and Army Career Skill Services that work and actively train service members in the military for the last 180 days of their service contract, all the while they're also receiving their military pay and their benefits. I'd like to provide some data from the Institute of Emerging Issues to allow some more context to the situation at hand. The United States Department of Defense reports that each year over 200,000 service members leave the military, transitioning back into civilian life. In 2019, they found that 47% of post-9/11 veterans said that the transition from military service to civilian life was somewhat to very difficult. About half of post-9/11 veterans found a job less than 6 months after starting their search, although 21% have found that it took 6 months to a year to find a job, and 16% reporting that it took over a year to find a job. So members that utilize these transition programs get set up for work before they leave the military their military contract. Some more details on the bill is this bill establishes a 2% bidder preference, but it is capped at $5,000. An eligible entity for this bill is are those that have employed at least one person enrolled in or recently graduated from the United States Department of Defense, SkillBridge, or Army Career Skills Service members, or their spouses. I'd like to think of this bill as supporting the pipeline for exiting service members so that service members can get employed, we can retain more of our state workforce, and also businesses getting bids for it. These programs are already established in all throughout Alaska, supporting all types of professions. For example, Army Career Skills Services has locations in Fort Wainwright and Richardson. Our DoD SkillBridge has 30 partners in Anchorage and about 8 partners in Fairbanks. I know our active duty men and women are highly trained in both skills and leadership and have an incredible work ethic. It's just a matter of getting them lined up for jobs. Thank you. I'd be willing to take any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Rouser.
Thank you, through the chair. Okay, so I'm going to show my ignorance a little bit here. So on page 1, line 11, a 2% preference shall be applied. Can you give me the math on how that works?
Representative, this is Callahan through the chair to Representative Rouser. Thank you for your question. So it's a 2% bidder preference. An example with the cap at $5,000. So an example I'd like to give, let's say there was a contract for $1 million. The state would not be giving $20,000; would be capped at $5,000 for the bidder preference. Does that give a little bit more context to what you're looking for?
Well, not through the chair.
Follow up.
No, but let me try to explain what I thought I heard you try to say. If a contract is $1 million that the contractor bid on, and he bid $1 million and got the contract, then you're saying he would, because it's over 5,000, he would get what for $5,000 worth of what? I guess I'm trying to understand what that means.
Through the chair to Representative Rauscher, it would be $5,000 off of the price of their contract. $5,000 off.
Okay. All right. So through the chair.
Hold on.
So he's bidding against other contractors, and so if his bid is, say, $5,000 more, or let's say $4,000 more than the last contractor, because there's four or five of these guys bidding, and the guy closest to him is $4,000 cheaper, he gets it because he's now $5,000 cheaper. Is that correct?
Through the chair to Representative Rauscher.
The guy closest to him is $4,000 below him, but he gets it because he just got $5,000 off of his bid. Is that what we're hearing?
Mr. Callahan, do you have anyone on the line? Be able to.
I have the Department of the Liaison for Military and Veterans Affairs, if she's willing to take those.
Yes. Extraordinaire, Ms. Angela LaFlame.
I didn't even know it was a good question. It's just what.
No, it is a good question. Thank you for the record. This is Angela LaFlame, Legislative Liaison for Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. And before I answer, I'll preface that I do have a Level 3 Procurement Officer certification with the state, and so I'm familiar with the procurement process. The way that preferences are applied, you're correct. So they would take the preference claimed by the bidder. They would take the 2% off of what their total is, which this has a max of 5,000. So let's say the math came out to they get the total preference. The bid with the lower amount after the preference is applied would win, but it doesn't reduce the amount of the contract award. So we would still be paying the amount bid, but they would win because they had a lower bid with the preference. Does that make sense?
It did up until the last sentence.
Okay.
Up through the chair.
Follow up, please.
Follow up. Okay. So they got $1 million anyway. Is that what your last sentence said? That's what I heard you
yes,
say.
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, the preference does not change the amount of the bid offered. It just gives them a preference that we would select them based on the reduction because of the preference.
Was I right? Or were
you were right.
Okay. Okay.
Is that what you really wanted to hear?
I understood it my way and then I got lost again.
Sorry. Yes, sir. You were correct.
I appreciate it through the chair. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you. Representative Great.
Sure. Thank you. Through the chair, following up on Representative Rauscher's question, so it might be for Ms. LaFlamme. So the agency that's going to be paying, as I understood what you just said, there's a 2% preference. So in some cases, we might pay 2% more because than another bidder. Because, I mean, is that correct? Like in one sort of like weird universe where they were that close in their bids, we might actually end up paying more to use the veteran than we would use the non-veteran contractor.
Please join us again.
Sorry, I shouldn't have. For the record, again, Angela LaFlamme, through the chair, Representative Gray, yes, that is correct. It doesn't reduce the award amount, just the ranking of offers.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm not sure if Mr. Callahan or Ms. LaFlame is best. Probably not Angela. Is participation in the SkillBridge program a voluntary or a mandatory program?
It's voluntary.
Yeah, through the chair. It is a voluntary program. It's a Department of Defense program that is offered that businesses can apply for and become part of. And it allows the Department of Defense to essentially pay for a service member's salary while they are participating in the program with a business. So it helps with the transition between military service and civilian.
Hello.
So if voluntary, I appreciate that. What percentage of members leaving service participate in the SkillBridge program?
That might be a question for Caleb. I'm not sure.
Through the chair, to Representative Sadler, I don't have those numbers off the top of my head, although I think our invited testimony, if he's online, he might have some gauge because he's pretty involved in the program. And
Mr.
I've got questions that probably might be answered by the invited testimony. So okay.
Mr. Kaiser, are you on the line?
Yes, this is Kyle Kaiser. I'm on the line.
Could you put yourself on the record and state your affiliation? We have a question for you.
My name is Kyle Kaiser. I'm the president and founder of Viper Transitions.
Would you mind asking your question again? Representative Sadler.
Oh, I'm sorry. Through the chair, Mr. Kaiser, my question was going to be what percentage of members leaving service participate in the SkillBridge program. I'm not sure if you can answer that, but if you can, take a whack at it, please.
Thank you, sir. Through the chair, so that is kind of a loaded question as far as specific numbers. There's a lot of variables in place. Every transitioning service member goes through the transitions office. Their participation in a SkillBridge program depends on command approval, acceptance into the program with the intent of employment at the end of it. So it's a process to go through. It starts a year out from separation. They're eligible to start engaging with employers and SkillBridge providers for employment opportunities post-military career. And when they hit their six-month window before separation, they're allowed to attend training to get the necessary skills for employment. And then they're eligible for employment once they separate from the military. So everybody goes through the same standardized briefing, and then it really is dependent upon what programs are available and what employment opportunities are available, who goes into what program.
Well, follow up.
And what I'm trying to get to, my questions are kind of leading up to the Section 2 of this bill before us, Senate Bill 154, allows the bidder preference of 2% to those who are qualified Alaska bidders and who are qualified entities or employed by a qualified entity. And that is an organization that employs somebody who has participated in the SkillBridge program. And there's an or here, or an Army Career Skills Program for service members that does some fairly specific stuff. So my question is the entire universe of service members leaving service going to qualify for this preference, or is there some that will not? And if not, where is that differentiation line?
So everybody would qualify for this program. The difference between SkillBridge and the CSP is the CSP is the Army's specific version. They have a few more qualifications as far as employment opportunities are concerned and things of that nature, but it covers everybody from the Coast Guard and all the branches.
Follow up.
And just because we love acronyms in the Army, but not so much the legislature. CSP stands for what, sir?
Oh, sorry. That's the Army Career Skills Program.
Very good. And just to clarify, so you're saying every service member who departed service would qualify for this 2% bidder who either under the CSP or under the SkillBridge, everyone would qualify, Coast Guard, Army, Air Force, Marines, Space Force, everybody.
Yeah, any service member who goes through one of the approved transition programs with either DOD and the SkillBridge or the Army's version of SkillBridge, the Career Skills Program, would qualify.
And if I can parse it one more
Absolutely.
Thing, sure, I appreciate your indulgence. So So the Army's CSP covers soldiers, and SkillBridge covers airmen, sailors, Marines, and Space Force members. Is that correct? So everybody who is going to be covered by one of these two, either SkillBridge or the CSP, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Thank you for your answers.
Representative Groh.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to clarify and thank Representative Sadler for asking his questions, because as someone who represents a number of Air Force members as well as Army members, I wanted to make sure that the Air Force was covered. I think that we clarified that, and as he said, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Kaiser. I have a question. How long has the SkillBridge program been around? I've only heard of it this year. I've worked with several individuals who were in the program. So could you give me some insight to that?
SkillBridge has been around for, I'm sorry. I'd
like to welcome Senator Wilikowski. Please continue.
So SkillBridge has been around for a number of years. I believe the start of really everything happened in 08. I know we've been actively working the SkillBridge and transitions window in Alaska for the last 6. So it's not a new program. It's just something that doesn't get a lot of attention in support.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from the committee? Senator, would you like to give some remarks?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bill Wilikowski, State Senator for East Anchorage. And just appreciate you taking up the bill. And I have nothing to add. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Sadler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I just want to kind of probe in this. I want to make sure you understand. Are there, I'm going to ask the same general question I asked. The bitter preference bill, Section 2 of your bill, has some pretty specific participation requirements. But what it kind of sounds like is this is a bitter preference for any veteran who's a qualified Alaska bidder. Am I understanding this correctly? Or?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Sadler. So this would apply to any bidder that employs people who or has employed people who are going through it's in Section 2, lines 14 and 15. Talks about what a qualified entity is. Employs at least one person who is currently enrolled in or within the previous 2 years graduated from a United States Department of Defense. So it tracks the employer, and the employer is going out and employing or has employed somebody who's in one of these programs.
Follow up.
Thank you. That is the black letter of the bill. I'm just trying to probe, is there any departing service member who would not meet one of these two qualifications, either going through the Army Career Service Program or going through the SkillBridge? Is there any veteran or any departing service member not qualified under that, those two qualifications?
Through the chair, I would, to my best of my knowledge, no.
Good. Okay.
And if I could, I could provide maybe another comment. So eligible entities, and as what Senator Wilikowski was saying, it tracks the employer. So as long as a business has hired at least one person who has done the SkillBridge program, that would mean that that business has partnered with DOD to offer internships, apprenticeship programs to funnel people from DOD to that business. If that adds a little bit more clarity, I hope.
Follow up.
I appreciate your indulgence, sir. And I support and have advocated and passed legislation to support departing service members making the transition from uniformed service to civilian service using their military training. I think it's admirable. It's a great goal, and it's a really decent thing to do for the men and women who wear the uniform. I'm just wondering if everybody who leaves service qualifies. It's hard to ask a legislator why you didn't do something else because you brought us what you did do, but why would you not simply add that 2% preference to any Alaska veteran or any company that employed an Alaska veteran?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Sadler, that's actually a great point. So there already is a veteran preference, and it's actually larger than the one we're offering today. And so it actually strengthens the it strengthens the pipeline even more so. So the veteran preference that's already in statute is for 5%. However, it doesn't cover people who are becoming veterans. Again, we're targeting the transitioning veterans. So if a business was eligible under this bidder preference, they would have the 2%. If they retained that employee and they continued working there, then they would actually qualify for the 5% veteran preference. And so they'd actually be getting more. And to clarify, these preferences don't stack. So they would be getting the veteran preference of 5% or the one we're offering today of 2%.
And to clarify, this is a preference given to someone, an entity that employs a veteran, not for the veteran himself.
Yes.
I believe there are other provisions. There's some veteran preference in, as individual veterans hiring gets a little boost in their score for state employment. So thank you for the answer.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, just inspired by Representative Sadler's line of questioning, I mean, my understanding is you become a veteran when you have a DD-214, which happens pretty fast. So wouldn't you be a veteran right away? That's the question.
Actually, you're a veteran from the day you joined the military. I know that sounds weird, but that's the way I see you. After day one. Yes, Representative Carpenter.
I would just like to have something clarified. I separated from, retired from the military in 2018, and I don't believe that I participated in the United States Army Career Skills Program. So to answer your question, Representative Sadler, not every departing service member is going to be in the Career Skills Program. I did not participate in industry training, pre-apprenticeships, registered apprenticeships, or internships during the last 180 days. I just separated. Those aren't things that I was interested in. So there would be some veterans that don't participate. But, I mean, I'm not opposed to this. Basically, what this is saying is let's promote the Skill Bridge and United States Army Career Skills Program or the civilian spouses who meet these qualifications with this privilege.
Seeing no further other questions, Mr. Kyle Kaiser, did you have a testimony you wanted to share with us, or were you just here for questions?
This is Kyle Kaiser, president and founder of Viper Transitions. I had prepared some talking points, and I think it kind of covers a little bit of what everybody's asking on. If you'd like me to give my remarks, I will. But I'm also open to answering questions.
If you will, please.
So the intent, everybody's getting to the right space on the intent behind why I support this is, it is true that not every service member goes through a Skill Bridge or Army Career Skills Program. And what we're trying to do is to create a mechanism to support that. Most of the service members who go through these types of programs are E1 through E6. So they're first or second term enlisted service members, and they have a harder time transitioning into employment on their way out the door. So the goal of this is to really show the state support for workforce development from our veteran population. Having done this for about 6 years now, we retain only about 20% of the vets that go through these programs. So what we're trying to encourage is more participation from the employers in the state of Alaska to help us retain veterans who would like to stay in Alaska, but that might not have the needed skills from their military service to actually gain employment in the state. So rather than seeing a lot of them leave, we'd like to see more of them stay. And I view this as a mechanism to help facilitate that environment. If we're talking to all these veterans and a bunch of them are leaving because there's no opportunities, if we can use this to create the opportunities for them to stay in Alaska and stay in our communities, I see that as a huge benefit.
Thank you, Mr. Kaiser. Are there any questions? Yeah. Representative Carpenter?
I have one that might be for legal. If they're not online, I can ask it later. So the question I have is this 2% preference within the state's procurement statutes in addition to any other veteran preference that would be that entity would be eligible for? Meaning it could be a total of 7% preference, because we've already established there's a 5% veterans preference. So I'm just curious if it doubles up, if both of them will apply.
Yeah, this is Callahan through the chair to Representative Carpenter. I did confirm with legal, they're not on the line right now, but I did confirm earlier that the preferences do not stack. So they wouldn't be getting a 7%. They'd be getting the veteran preference of 5% or the bidder preference of 2%.
Thank you.
Representative Ross.
Yeah, through the chair, thank you. I just had one more question. We talked about having employees who fit these qualifications. What if the contractor himself is the only employee and he does qualify as one, but he's not an employee, he's just the contractor? Is he still work?
Brief and easy. Just back on record. Representative Rouse, would you please?
Through the chair, thank you. You thought the question over, and I think you hit it. Basically, does the contractor count if he has no other employees that actually fit in Section 2, and he is actually the veteran? Does this also count?
Through the chair to Representative Rauscher, that's an excellent question. I don't have a firm answer for you now, but I would be happy to deliver that to your office personally.
Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, we will open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room that would like to publicly testify? Is there anyone on the line that would like to publicly testify? Seeing none, we will now close public testimony. Are there any final questions for the bill sponsor or the testifiers? Seeing none, seeing no further questions, I will set amendment deadline for SB 154 for Wednesday, April 24th at noon, and we will set the bill aside, and it will be taken up at a future meeting. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
We'll take a brief at ease for the next presenter. Friends Affairs is back on record. Brief it is. Military Veterans Affairs is back on record. Now, the next item on our agenda today is first reading for the HB 373 Service of Armed Forces of the State. Representative Eastman, would you please come forth and put yourself on the record?
Thank you, Representative David Eastman, House District 27.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. Would you please go ahead and start your presentation?
Thank you. It's my privilege this morning to present House Bill 373, also known as the Defend the Guard Act. You can find many other states have dealt with and are working through similar legislation. There are two provisions to the Defend the Guard Act. One makes clear that a member serving in the Alaska State Defense Force would not be eligible to serve in the Alaska National Guard and vice versa. And also, probably the more interesting aspect of the bill is that if a Alaska National Guardsman were to be deployed overseas under combat conditions, that service or assisting with combat would of necessity only take place under constitutional authorities. Namely, would the action have been declared under war by Congress? If not, then a National Guardsman would be prevented from deploying into overseas combat until that authority takes place. It would not impact training overseas. Training could occur anywhere on planet or in space, to be technical. Likewise, the provisions for calling forth of militia to perform constitutional authorized activities anywhere in the U.S., of course, would not be impacted either. So the definition of the United States is specific. Any territory that's possessed by the United States any territory or state, District of Columbia, and so forth. Fairly comprehensive definition. And so if the National Guardsmen were to be deployed to any of those locations, House Bill 373 would not relate to that deployment. It's only when they're going overseas, that's when House Bill 373 would apply.
Are there any questions for the bill sponsor? Representative Groh?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, a whole bunch of members of the National Guard have been deployed in war zones, as your materials point out. Tragically, a number have also been killed and wounded, as your materials that you included in the packet also pointed out. It strikes me that there has been litigation about this question before, in the sense that I'll just ask you directly, and I'll probably have a follow-up, however you answer. Are you aware, Representative Eastman, if there have been lawsuits brought by members of the National Guard challenging the constitutionality of their deployment to war zones, I think specifically in recent years of Iraq and Afghanistan? So that's the first question. Are you aware of such litigation?
The case that comes to mind most immediately would be Perpich versus Department of Defense. And that was litigated all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, dealt with some governors attempting to impose or intervene when guardsmen were deployed overseas for training purposes. And under those circumstances, the Supreme Court was very clear that training purposes are allowable. Congress has the authority to determine, you know, how training is conducted. The state does preside over the training when it's the National Guard. And so the question of can, you know, governors say, no, we don't want to deploy our National Guard for training purposes to, in this case, I think South America was the contentious issue of the day. The answer is no. They can be deployed for training purposes anywhere in the world.
A follow-up, Mr. Chairman, please. I thank you, Representative Eastman, and through the chair. So I understand what you're saying is the holding of that particular U.S. Supreme Court case. And I take it from your answer, Representative Eastman, that you're not aware of any cases that have decided at any level of our court systems this precise question of whether members of the National Guard can be ordered into combat zones, say, as I said, most recently, Iraq and Afghanistan. Is that correct?
See, I don't have particulars on some of those court cases and litigation, but I would defer to Mr. Gobb, who's available to testify online.
I'm happy to hear, Mr. Chairman, this person has expertise.
Yes, let's open it up. Mr. Gobb, are you on the line?
Also, we have Michael Meharry is also available online.
Mr. Chair, this is Darren Gobb. I am online, yes.
Perfect. Did you hear the question stated?
I did hear the question stated in the most pertinent case that is out there in case law was already mentioned by Representative Eastman. If there are individual lawsuits at a lower level by individual service members across the branches, I am unaware of any right now. And this is the most relevant legislation to this issue in multiple states around the country. I hope that answers your question, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Gobb. We do have a follow-up for you.
Thank you. It's actually more for the chairman directly. Given the very substantial legal constitutional issues presented by this legislation, I would prefer to get a legal opinion from legislative legal, at least have them on the line if we don't have a memo. I will say right up front, I have not asked for this. You know, I was reviewing this bill and the supporting materials today, but I would be very interested, Mr. Chairman, in such a legal opinion on that question, given how often it has occurred in recent years that national members of the National Guard have been deployed to combat zones, and yeah, the substantial motivation for at least somebody involved to try to get a judicial termination of that question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And speaking through the chair to Representative Eastman, my question is, can Alaska National Guardsmen be deployed outside of Alaska as defined for a duty that is not in support of armed conflict and not for active service in a combat zone?
Yes, absolutely.
And follow-up?
Follow-up.
Any estimation through the chair to Representative Eastman, what percentage of deployed National Guardsmen serve in such capacity, one of those two conditions?
I don't currently have numbers, but I'm sure I know it does happen.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. Through the chair, the bill is currently written. Does it apply to M-Day, your 1 week in a month, 2 weeks a year soldiers, and AGR soldiers, active guard and reserve soldiers, one or the other or both?
So if a individual is currently serving in the militia, in the Alaska militia, then it would apply to them. If it's an individual who is not designated as a member of the militia, then it would not. And so then that becomes legal question, you know, under what circumstances are you a member of the militia? Does an active guard reserve position when in federal service, do they fall under the militia category? I guess to that, I would turn to Mr. Meharry for some expertise.
Mr. Meharry, are you available to take this question?
I am available. I missed the question.
Mr. Representative Carpenter, do you mind?
Mr. Meharry, the question is, this bill as written, does it apply to only M-Day soldiers or those soldiers that are drilling in a traditional sense, 1 week in a month, 2 weeks a year as a member of the organized militia? Or does it also apply to AGR members of the organized militia who are in a active guard and reserve status, who are in other words, on active duty, but serving within the guard?
My understanding is it would apply to any National Guard unit or National Guard member. So if they're not part of the Army or the Army Reserves, then this bill would apply to them. The purpose, obviously, is to stop unconstitutional deployments of the state militia into combat zone without proper constitutional authorization. So it should apply to any Guard member that is part of the National Guard.
Follow up.
Separate question. If soldiers within a National Guard unit are activated by presidential order or Department of Defense to serve, and they are placed in Title 32 or Title 10 status, then are they being ordered by the militia within the state? Or are they being ordered by the federal government? And would state law trump that decision by federal authorities?
Yes. The point of the bill is to authorize the governor to effectively say, no, we are not releasing our National Guard units into active duty combat without either a constitutional justification or a declaration of war. So I get the two titles mixed up, Title 10, Title 32. One of them is basically deployment into for domestic type of operations. And I believe it's Title 32 is deployment into to national combat. So it would prevent that into a combat situation without the proper authorization. And, you know, the important point to keep in the front of your mind is that we've been operating in a system for decades where the United States government has taken us into war without proper constitutional justification. And this is really an attempt to rein in especially executive overreach, where you have the President of the United States effectively going to war whenever he wants to. And this is far beyond anything that the Constitution was meant to authorize. The state militia was primarily meant to be a defense force and something to provide for the state. And this has been a big issue in a lot of states where you've had units deployed to Iraq, Afghanistan, or other combat zones. And then there's a natural disaster or an issue within the state, and those units aren't available. This was particularly something that happened during Hurricane Katrina, when Louisiana Guard units were actually deployed. They were having to scramble to find Guard units from other states to cover that activity. So this is really just trying to use your authority over your militia to try to kind of rein in this overreaching federal power that, that again, has been going on for decades.
I believe Title 10 is the federal activation and Title 32 is state active duty.
I get them mixed up.
No worries. Representative Rouser?
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. So I'm reading the legislative findings section and number 14 on page 1. And basically it talks about the Alaska National Guard and the Alaska State Defense Force. So just could you qualify the difference between those for us?
Between the Alaska State Defense Force and the National Guard?
Those two entities.
Certainly. Within the organized militia, you have both the Alaska State Defense Force, a much smaller unit, and then you also have the National Guard Force. Every state has a National Guard Force, and some states have a State Defense Force. Alaska is one of the states that has a State Defense Force. And those individuals receive training through the state and sometimes work with the National Guard, but are not either under or a part of the National Guard. It's exclusively a state-run organization, whereas the National Guard has both a state and a federal component.
And whoever's through the chair?
Follow up.
Who oversees that?
They have a commander.
Thank you very much.
Representative Gray?
Thank you. Through the chair, to the sponsor or invited testimony, doesn't matter. In my experience in the National Guard, most folks that I was in the Guard with wanted to deploy. And we were definitely more excited about combat deployments. There was more interest in those sorts of deployments. And so I agree that over the centuries, over the decades, the way the National Guard has been used has changed, but the way it is now is the way we recruit now, and we deploy a lot. And I think if you took the deployments away, you would have a real recruitment problem. Do you agree?
My impression, and I will say this, not having served in the National Guard, my impression is that you're right. There are many people who want to deploy and want to see combat situations. And then there are a very different group of people who would like to serve the National Guard and really don't want to do those, at least certainly not unless it's needed during a time of war, and are not, in the running to join the National Guard right now because the expectations are so skewed in the opposite direction that you will deploy. Your likelihood is high in any case in a lot of career specialties, and so the National Guard does not currently have the ability to take advantage of those people who would like to serve in our National Guard.
Representative Shaw,
through the chair, is the Naval Militia under this? Could the Naval Militia fall under this?
The Naval Militia falls under the militia category. And are part of our force. They're a separate part of our state militia.
Thank you.
Representative Sandler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, how many times, in your knowledge, has Congress declared war in the 20th century?
In the 20th century, there were at least two times, World War I and II, and those are the only two times that I'm aware of.
And what about in the 20, through the chair, in the 21st century?
Not at this time, fortunately.
So, Mr. Chairman, this bill seems to challenge what the current and accepted, at least for the last 124 years, function of the National Guard, at least the Alaska National Guard. I'm sorry, it has been Alaska National Guard. But just the role of the Alaska National Guard as an adjunct to the active duty force. So correct me if I'm wrong, this would have prevented, if this bill had been law, this would have prevented any Alaska National Guardsmen from deploying to Vietnam or the Korean conflict or Panama or Grenada or in any other armed conflicts that occurred absent a formal declaration of war by Congress. Am I correct?
Yes, Congress would have been encouraged to make that declaration, and then all those individuals could have deployed at that point.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions for the bill sponsor? Follow-up?
Thank you. Not a follow-up, but a different. On Section 3 of the bill, the prohibition through the chair to Representative Eastman, the prohibition on somebody serving in the Alaska State Defense Force and the Alaska National Guard concurrently. Is that an issue? Are there many people that try to or do concurrently serve?
I think that's to alleviate any confusion over the intent. And right now, the intent would be that those remain two separate organizations. I know fewer people are aware even of the State Defense Force and sort of what they do and what their role is. And sometimes they're confused as being part of the National Guard. They aren't currently, and this just makes it clear in statute that they shouldn't, you know, have someone who's both part of the National Guard, which can be deployed out of state, and part of the State Defense Force, which exists for those situations when the National Guard is deployed. I mean, if you had the National Guard in state all the time, you would have much less of a reason for even having a State Defense Force.
So follow up. So there's not actually a problem that this is solely to eliminate confusion. There's not actually anybody who's trying to serve concurrently. Is that correct?
I'm not aware of anyone currently, no.
Okay.
Thank you. We do have some folks on the line who are answering questions. Mr. Michael Murray, do you have a testimony you'd like to provide for us?
Yes, sir. My name is Mike Meharry. I appreciate the chairman and the committee members hearing me. I'm not going to really go through everything because some of the questions were actually answered. I was going to speak at length about the Purpich decision. And again, this is the Supreme Court decision that does limit the governor's discretion when it comes to guard deployments in a training situation. But it's important to understand that this Supreme Court case only addressed the issue of training overseas and did not touch on the issue of combat deployments. I think the most important thing that I would like to leave with the committee is that this is really about reestablishing a proper constitutional balance when it comes to war powers. And the committee member that mentioned the fact that we've not had a declaration of war since World War II, that's a problem. And we're simply trying to create a situation where Congress will do its job. We have a situation today where generally Congress just punts the decision to the president. And if you go back and read the founders, James Madison and many others talked extensively about the fact that they did not want a single individual making the decision as to whether or not the United States would go to war. They wanted that to be done in Congress because it is a deliberative body that actually represents the people. And the whole system has been flipped on its head. And so the hope would be if enough states were to pass this bill and limit the deployment of their guard units to a declaration of war, then perhaps Congress would be more inclined to actually do its job. And I think that's a very important point. James Madison put it this way. He said, the executive has no right in any case to decide the question whether there is or is not a cause for declaring war. The president should be outside of the decision. It should be made by Congress. And of course, Congress doesn't really want to do its job because, you know, it's a difficult decision to make. So this is really the whole point of the bill. And it is true that it would make it more difficult for the federal government to deploy these units without a declaration of war. That's the point of the bill. I want to leave you guys with an actual quote from Daniel Webster. And this was actually in 1814.
during the War of 1812, the issue had come up about federalizing the militia for the War of 1812. And many folks, especially in some of the northern states that tended to be more opposed to this war, felt like it was an abuse of Congress's power. And this is what Daniel Webster said about actions similar to what the Alaska Defendant Guard Act would do. He said, the operation of measures, thus unconstitutional and illegal, ought to be prevented by a resort to other measures, which are both constitutional and legal. It will be the solemn duty of the state governments to protect their own authority over their own militia and to interpose between their citizens and arbitrary power. These are among the objects for which the state governments exist. So with that in mind, I do urge you to vote yes on HB 373. You're not only asserting your own control of your own militia, you are also helping to restore an important constitutional balance, which has been lost. Thank you guys very much for your attention.
I thank you for that testimony, Mr. Meharry. We do have a question for you. Representative Shaw.
My question is basically, it's more of a comment than a question. And it's really to Representative Gray and Representative Sadler's points. The Guard, as well as the active duty, is a volunteer organization. And from what I know, having served in both, that the oath of office you take is to defend and support the Constitution of the United States. It doesn't so much say the state of Alaska. So I think the points that were made by Rep. Sadler and Rep. Gray should carry a lot of weight relative to the fact that whether you're active duty or Guard, you take an oath to support and defend.
Thank you, Representative Shaw. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. Probably for the bill sponsor, maybe for the supporters here. Is it your position that the only time that the U.S. should exercise its military capacity is during a declaration of war?
No, I think that the bill is a lot more limited than that. It simply says that the only time a guardsman should be sent overseas for combat, that should be in furtherance of a declaration of war. And that's the difference, you know, between an offensive war and maybe a defensive war or offensive and defensive military operations. But in any case, this doesn't, you know, in any way limit active duty from being used in any number of different ways. It simply says that the role of the National Guard is constitutionally very different and should be treated differently. We've lost that distinction. And I think, you know, to the point where they're treated more or less interchangeably. You know, my own personal experience, I supervised guardsmen in Afghanistan during Katrina. Actually, we're an Alabama Guard unit, and they were, you know, obviously not in Alabama to help with the hurricane when that was going down, because they were engaged in effectively combat operations in Afghanistan. And so this would limit that opportunity since there was no, you know, declaration of war. If there aren't any further questions, I'd like to invite our second testifier to provide his presentation. And this was, and I didn't designate that this is Representative Eastman from District 27 speaking again. Thank you.
Would that be Mr. Gobb?
Yes.
Mr. Gobb, would you go ahead with your testimony, please?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for your time. My name is Darren Gobb. Last name is spelled G-A-U-B, and I live in Helena, Montana. And I'd like to go quickly through a little bit of background so you know why I've testified to this bill in multiple states across the nation as a subject matter expert, and then go quickly into what the Defend the Guard bill is not, then what it is. And I'll conclude quickly after that and stand by for questions. So I served 28 years in service from private to lieutenant colonel, active duty to National Guard, and also commanded at the brigade level. Did 7 deployments, Korea, all over Europe, North Africa, 4 tours in Afghanistan, and was on a fast-track career and decided to end my career to uphold my oath instead and do what was right. Since then, I founded an organization called Restore Liberty alongside Brigadier General Retired Blaine Holt and the Global Veterans Coalition. And so I was asked to testify to this important bill because of a few key areas of my personal experience and expertise.
I've commanded the units up to 3,500 personnel at the brigade level. I've served as a global military strategist and served under DOD Title 10 and Title 32 authorities multiple times. I've worked with base realignment and closure around the world, force structure, active in guard at the theater level, all sorts of budgets, and provided expert testimony on policy, geopolitics, and strategy to DOD, federal, and multiple state-level organizations, and up to four states now on Defend the Guard. Because of all of this, there are four major nationwide TV media outlets that currently count on my expertise and analysis for geopolitics, military, and constitutional concerns, and been picked up and published by Real Clear Defense, Armed Forces Press, and others working specifically on Defend the Guard and why it's important. So first of all, Defend the Guard is not anything about misunderstanding the structure of the National Guard mission and its purpose. There's no impact to that. This is inherent upon the Congress to act appropriately in accordance with the Constitution. There's no issue and impact on force structure from personnel to equipment. Most of these threats are empty that have been leveled by Pentagon agencies and others. That is simply not true. This is not moving the National Guard to a state-centric security force, nor is it a desire to create or pit one state against another. It's just, again, simply do their duty. Congress do their duty in accordance with the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8. And because of this, I think all states should support this legislation, as all you're doing is telling the federal government you expect them to act in accordance with the U.S. Constitution. Therefore, this is not an unconstitutional bill in any way, shape, or form. In fact, it is the height of what is constitutional. The bill's purpose is to ensure the Constitution is followed. In Article 1, Section 8, that's still in force, hasn't been changed. And in fact, the president can only serve as the wartime commander-in-chief when authorized by Congress. And Congress can act very quickly if needed. So this is not a concern about our ability to react to threats, nor is it a concern about our ability to defend ourselves overseas or here. That right to defense always exists. So the bill is about the U.S. Constitution in all case law to date. This is about states' rights under the 10th Amendment, ensuring the federal government functions as required. This is about not sending America's sons and daughters to overseas conflicts based on the whim of a president, but pursuant to congressional authorities only. And the rest of that's already been covered, and I agree with everything that's been said so far. Ultimately, though, it's about your willingness to stand up and keep the promise you made in your oath of office. A yes vote to pass this legislation shows that your word and your support to your oath matters. And I appreciate the opportunity to provide the facts concerning this legislation and dispel the lies and rumors you will probably or may have heard from others in opposition to this about threats to basing and equipment and money. All of that is just empty. And I ask you to support this bill in a way that costs you nothing with a simple yes vote when those who swore the oath to protect and defend the Constitution, that's all this is about, were willing to pay for that oath with their lives. And so I'll be willing to stand for any questions if you have anything, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gobb. Are there any questions? Representative Groh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gobb, I guess I have a more than one question. One is, would you agree that there's a difference between what some of the views of some commentators or citizens might be about philosophy or about what constitutional law should be on the one hand, and on the other hand, what the courts might hand down as rulings as what, you know, the Constitution means in certain circumstances? Is there a difference between policy and philosophy on the one hand and the actual binding constitutional laws expressed through decisions on the other?
Mr. Chair, Representative, of course, there's going to be differences of opinion when it comes to these kinds of things. But what hasn't changed is the Constitution and its plain language in Article 1, Section 8. And that has actually been upheld by the Supreme Court because they limited their opinion and purpose to say that they can go overseas and train. They did not address that they can go overseas and go to war because Congress didn't declare war. Therefore, they couldn't go in the first place. And I know that we're way past that, and that's what we're trying to get back to is adherence to the Constitution, because adherence to the Constitution is not subject to people's opinions.
Thank you. Follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow-up?
Mr. Chairman, it's more of a comment at this point. I do think that the testimony of the witnesses and of the sponsor help underscore the importance of getting a legal opinion before we proceed on this legislation. And thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. Is there a difference between using active component members without a declaration of war and reserve component members without a declaration of war from a presidential decision to do so?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm assuming that question is still for me.
Sure, he can take a stab at it.
Yes, thank you. Ultimately, Article 1, Section 8 applies to all members of any military force and to the Congress. And it simply says Congress must declare war before anybody in these states can take part in conflict. Sure, there's a difference between the reaction time of active duty versus National Guard, but that particular part of the Constitution applies to everybody equally. And the problem has been that this authorization for use of military force that is still in effect 20 something years later after the global war on terror started is now being used as an excuse to send people overseas into conflict zones for decades on end. And we have to end that because it's just going to keep people in a perpetual state of conflict with, you know, ceding all authorities to the president to do whatever he thinks he needs to when that is contrary to exactly what the founding fathers were concerned about. I hope that answers the question. Thank you.
A follow-up?
Follow-up.
So thank you, and that does answer that question. I think we tend to be in agreement. So the question that I posed to Representative Eastman earlier, I'll pose to you, is a declaration of war the only time that the U.S. Commander-in-Chief should use military force?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and I think there is a line there that I'm going to try to describe in two different ways. One of them is, if we're going to the Middle East and we're going to cross the berm into Kuwait and into Iraq, invading a foreign nation in a conflict, we, the people and the states of this nation, have the right and we require that the federal government listen to our voices and we collectively make the assessment on the risk of whether that is worth it to us or not. That's universal in all parts of the military and always should be. What should not be impacted and would not be impacted in this case is our right to self-defense with all forces of the military as well. Active Guard, Reserve, doesn't matter. And that's been one of the concerns that's been leveled, is that, you know, will the National Guard take part in defending this nation? Well, of course it will. And if, you know, if our nation is attacked directly from a foreign entity, then the National Guard will respond as it would be expected to. But if we think that we're going to just go over and invade foreign nations at the whim of the president, we can't do that. But self-defense, it's always there, it always will be, and it should remain a right at all times.
Well, my question wasn't answered. I don't know what to do with that. I could pose it again.
Would you please?
So the question is the president, I'll rephrase, that's what I'll do. Should the president be able to use military force only when a declaration of war has been authorized by Congress?
I guess the easy answer is no, he can't. The difference being that under the War Powers Act, he has a time frame when he can operate as necessary within up to 60 days, I believe that number is, before he has to go to Congress and get authorization for funding to take that conflict beyond a certain amount of time. Otherwise, it would have to cease without a congressional action. Fortunately, the Congress can act if it needs to within hours.
If we pass this bill and in theory, we're able to restrict the Alaska National Guard's ability to be mobilized by the president if he ordered it, then within that time period that the president has authorized, to use military force, he would be able to use military force, but not the National Guard. He would only be limited to active duty. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. I think there's a, Mr. Chair, Representative, I think there's a realization of the fact that the National Guard takes a while to get moving. And that time frame is going to consume most of the National Guard's willingness and ability to partake in that conflict. Most of that will be covered by the active duty already anyways, if I understand your question correctly.
Follow through the chair. Sidestep the question. There are active duty units that have a high level of readiness, but most active duty units are also not able to deploy on a moment's notice. National Guard units, there are some that cannot deploy on a moment's notice, and there are others that are maintain a higher level of active duty or readiness. Thank you. The question is a germane one, that if the president is able to use the full force and might of the United States military, but only for a short period of time, and we pass a bill that says, well, you can't use our forces during your period of time, Congress has to act first, then we are inhibiting the president's ability to deal with a situation immediately.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would say that that's an extremely rare circumstance, and when you have to act immediately, the active duty forces will take care of that by and large. They can initiate movement with any member of the military across the country active to National Guard. And in that process, during that time, Congress can go ahead and act and do its constitutionally mandated duty of declaring war. And the whole point of that is they are authorizing the president to act as commander-in-chief in wartime, which he is not supposed to be able to do beyond that time frame without congressional authority anyway. So ultimately what you're doing is you're telling Congress to do their job.
I don't have any other questions. I would just like to say that we probably are not going to move a whole lot of our aircraft without reserve refuelers.
Tankers.
Thank you.
All righty. Well, it looks like we have to open up public testimony at this time. Thank you, Mr. Gopp. I'm opening public testimony. Oh, you're very welcome. Is there anyone in the room that would like to publicly testify? Anyone on the line? Seeing none. I will now close public testimony. Are there any final questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, we will now set HB.
Wrap up real quick.
Absolutely.
Sure. I just didn't want to. This is Representative Eastman. I appreciated the questions earlier and wanted to make sure that my intent as a sponsor was clear on the record. If you're talking about defensive operations, then the National Guard should be available for those. One of the ways that that becomes available is by Congress quickly acting to make them available. And right now we're in an unfortunate situation where we've drifted so far from that reality. I think there's no expectation that anyone in Congress would quickly act on terms of anything. So I look ahead with a bill such as this to making that clear, that the expectation in the Constitution is, and today in 2024 should be, that Congress is going to act proactively when the situation requires. They, as Congress, don't have to wait for the president or the military to do anything. They can initiate a declaration of war or other action on their own authority. And when there is a threat and the U.S. is facing a threat, then they should be encouraged to do so. And I think this legislation will encourage that. I don't expect that situation is going to change overnight. I expect that it's not just one state that is going to be providing that encouragement, but many other states as well, of which Alaska is just one. If there are missiles inbound, I want the National Guard to be able to do everything they can to defend our country. And I don't think anything in this bill is going to limit that. Provided security, during my own military service at Greeley and engaged and interacted and worked alongside some of the guardsmen that are stationed there defending our country. I absolutely want to provide them all the resources and support, especially the political support from elected leaders that they need to do their job. Thank you.
Outstanding. Thank you, Representative Eastman. Seeing no further questions, are there any questions? We will now set this bill aside. That concludes our agenda for today. If there is no other business, the House Special Committee on Military Veterans Affairs will adjourn at 2:15 p.m.